Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join our conversations on the exchange, you can do so. Phone number is here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Classes are still 2 weeks away at the state universities in Oregon. All seven campuses begin the academic year on September 30th. But before classes start, work could stop for classified, read non-faculty, workers. The Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, represents many of the classified workers, and SEIU members voted to authorize a strike at the state universities soon if contract demands are not met. Mark Neisenfeld is the SEIU Local 503 Bargaining Team Chair and our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's start with the easy stuff. What is a classified employee?
Well, classified employees, people call them student service workers. So we're the groundskeepers, the custodians, the food service workers, facilities workers, all the clerical staff throughout the library techs, IT support, everything, the infrastructure that keeps the university running.
Does that include things like security officers, police?
Oh, CPSO as well, yeah, the campus public safety officers and the nurses that are on campus, just pretty much everyone who keeps the buildings open and keeps the students healthy, safe, and served.
So simply no faculty or administration, is that basically everybody else is considered a classified employee?
Yeah, pretty much. There's a few that are unclassified that are in the administration, but they're not managers and that sort of thing. But, they're not supervisors. They might be unclassified for confidential reasons, something like that. But pretty much anybody who's not faculty or administration.
All right. So, Mark, who is represented? How many represented by SEIU across the seven campuses of the Oregon University system?
We have about 4,300.
4,300.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Ashland, I think there's about 150. I'm not positive of the Ashland number. The statewide number is about 4,300.
And is this just the Oregon University system, the big seven campuses? Does it include community colleges as well?
It does not include community colleges.
Okay. So what's the story on the last contract? Has that, in fact, lapsed?
Well, it expired June 30th, and we got one extension to the end of July and a second extension to the end of August, but there's been no extension through September. We actually didn't ask for an extension through September in case we had a turn to work stoppage.
All right, so that the provisions of that remain in force, but obviously there's nothing in the way of planned pay increases while you're working without a contract, right?
Right, and the only things that, what remains in force is just what they call the status quo is wages and hours. They can't, you can't give people pay cuts, and if people are due an increase during the time, they have to get that increase, that sort of thing. But we lose, we don't have a grievance procedure, and there's some other things that aren't considered status quo that aren't in effect right now. But for the most part, people are still protected in their jobs, and they're still, they're going to get their wages and health insurance and all that.
All right. So, Mark, the contract that ended it with the end of June then, and you mentioned the two extensions for July and for August, how long was that in effect?
2 years.
2 years, okay.
Each contract is 2 years.
Never any longer than that?
Well, no, we've tried, but we've actually would rather have a longer contract because it keeps us paying attention. I mean, our bargaining team has been at this for since February now. So February 1st we started. So, going on 10 months that we've been doing it, and 9 months. Mm-hmm. And, it's not just us involved. All the members are involved, and faculty and administration are involved because they're all paying attention. And, it's a distraction from the work we need to provide for the students. It's a terrible distraction. And that's why we've tried to go longer term, but we've constantly been tied to the legislative cycle.
All right, I was going to ask, because it figured like a wild guess anyway, but probably a pretty good one, that they're trying to make sure that the contract specifies or tracks with the legislative biennial budget, which runs from July 1st of an odd-numbered year to June 30th of the next odd-numbered year.
Correct.
All right. So,
well, now with the with the disconnect from the gas contract from the state, we might see a willingness, not this time, but next time, with the three big universities having their own private institutional boards, we might see more of a desire to move away from the legislative cycle, but that's just maybe it's more of a hope than a prediction.
Right. And is there much in the legislation? I know there are some details still left to clean up about who ends up on those boards for Oregon State, University of Oregon, and Portland State, but does it specify whether they're in charge of the contracts or whether it's still OUS?
I'm not sure I understood your...
Well, you're talking about the institutional boards that will be created for the University of Oregon, Oregon State, and
right.
Portland State, the three biggest schools, and
right.
The possibility of longer contracts. But are the contracts, in fact, ultimately in the hands of the new institutional boards, or is that still something that they have to answer to the Oregon University system?
Oh, okay. No, the contracts are still part of the law that was passed was that there are some shared services, and collective bargaining is one of the shared services with the Oregon University system. So the contract will remain change the law. It remains at the hands of all seven universities bargaining together.
Mark Neisenfeld is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the union bargaining team chair for the SEIU Local 503, bargaining with the state universities or attempting to come up with a contract for the classified workers at the seven state university campuses of the Oregon University system. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with comments or questions or issues to raise involved in the contract and potential strike negotiations here. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned negotiations in process since February 1st. Has there been much movement in weeks, months? How would you characterize that, Mark?
Well, I'm glad you asked. We were in negotiations at Oregon State last Friday. We went into the evening, and Saturday we went late into the night, almost after 10 o'clock Saturday night. And there was some movement. There was shown some willingness by the administration to try and get this done. And the team got together after our last session, and we've since notified management and our members. We notified our members last night and management that we intend to withdraw our current strike notice, which was set for September 23rd, next Monday, and reissue a strike notice for September 30th, two weeks from today. And that would be the day that that classes are set to begin.
All right. So, but by withdrawing the strike notice and putting another one in for the 30th, does this require another vote of membership? Was there such a vote before?
No. It's a legal requirement. We have to give them at least 10 days notice of intent to strike. We got our strike authorization vote from the membership last week and put the first strike notice in. And we had fully intended to go out next Monday if we hadn't settled it, but we saw some real willingness of the administration to get it done. And they didn't ask us to do it. We did that on our own. We thought that, how's it said, it's better to stumble into peace than to rush into war.
Right.
So we decided to withdraw the notice and reissue for the 30th.
How different are the demands that you're seeking through this process versus what you had in the old contract?
Currently, we have on the table 2.5% cost of living allowance in each of the 2 years and full steps for our members. Now, to explain steps a little bit, each classification has a salary range with 10 steps. And the person's hired at the bottom, and each year they work their way toward the top, which is the 10th step, and they stay there until the only thing they get is cost of living allowances. And we feel the 10th step isn't even at market, but that's one of the sacrifices we make for working for a public institution and for having a little bit better benefits. We, you know, sacrifice salary for benefits, but they, and currently we're asking for the 2.5% cost of living allowance. That not only affects the people going through the steps, but everybody who's topped out, which is about 25% of our membership is at the top and has been for several years. The state has on the table, or OUS has on the table, 1.5% in December of each year. Ours are requested for July of each year. So 1.5%, not of each year, 1.5% December of this year, 2% December of next year, and half steps instead of full steps. We also have low wage floor. We have a lot of people in throughout the state that are working full time and earn less than the food stamp eligibility for a family of four. That's $2,500 a month. So our proposal is to move everyone so that no one in the system working full time would earn less than $2,500 a month, and that's not on the table for them either.
There's been some stuff in the media about the difference between those July and December steps. Does that ultimately add up to a fair amount of money for any individual?
Well, I mean, if they increase your salary in July to or 1.5, or we'll take our figure, 2.5%, you're starting at the beginning of the fiscal year with that 2.5%. If it starts in December, you've missed 6 months of it. So, yeah, that's the day it starts, of course, there's no difference in the money, but over the year, it's about 50% of the increase you would have gotten had it started on July 1st.
Is there any issue other than money that comes up in the middle of all this, Mark Nisenfeld?
Well, in the last year, we got the certification from, we organized the temporary workers. OUS employs a lot of temporary workers statewide. We asked the Employment Relations Board for what they call a unit clarification, and the unit clarification says yes or no, this group belongs in your bargaining unit. So they said they did, and we hence started an organizing campaign, and we had the vote in July, June or July, and it was a positive vote. It was actually an overwhelming vote to support the union and join the union. So I think it was July 23rd, the Employment Relations Board certified that vote, and these people were eligible to join the union. So the employer at first wanted to just start a new bargaining cycle for the temporary workers, and our position was that we wanted to roll the temporary workers into this contract negotiations and not just start up again and have another, 8 month campaign. And it's a horrible waste of state resources to do that. It's university resources, the day that the final offers were due in, they agreed to roll the temporary workers in. So there are a few issues for the temporary workers that we still haven't resolved, but I have full confidence that those will be resolved, that the temporary worker issue is not going to hold up a settlement for this contract. And we have, I think we have agreement on both sides that these issues will be resolved. For the most part, it's down to just a couple articles that still are left unresolved, and it's just really figuring out how they apply to temporary workers.
All right. So, but they will be rolled in then with the full-time folks, the permanent folks.
Yes, which also says that in the past, OUS, 1995 when we struck and 1987 when we struck, the university system used temporary workers to fill in the gaps where they needed people. Well, they won't be able to do that this time because the temps can go out on strike too.
Mark Neisenfeld is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, SEIU Local 503 Bargaining Team Chair. We're talking about the classified employees of the Oregon University System threatening strike. It's now not a September 30th threat, but a September 23rd threat, but is now authorized for September 30th if contract negotiations are unsuccessful. Phone numbers here in the exchange if you want to take part in this conversation, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Mark, do you and the university system come to the table with an ultimate dollar number? I mean, with a, you know, this is going to cost the university system X number of dollars over the next 2 years. Or 4 years,
well,
or whatever, you know.
Each time we put a proposal in, it it's accompanied by costing, and I can't. I'm not the numbers guy. I can't get into. I get the numbers. I don't have them in front of me.
But it's more than percentages. People have factored out what happens when you get X number of people with this much more money. It's going to cost
exactly.
this much. Okay.
Exactly. And they already know the baseline of course, of what. Benefits and retirement, you know, health benefits, retirement, and current salaries are. So it's just a matter of adding. This is the additional cost in this biennium.
Is there any effect on the negotiation process caused by the issues with the legislature potentially meeting, oddly enough, on September 30th, the day that you voted to authorize the strike now, to talk about the possibility of making some changes to the public employee retirement system? Is that any part of this contract negotiation?
It is not. I mean, other than some, our bargaining team members are all a little nervous about what the legislature might do, but it is not part of the conversation.
The argument often from the university system is money. I'm sure that's been discussed, that they just don't have it or don't have as much as perhaps you'd like. I mean, as you watch the process and the public is aware of this, that the state support for the public universities continues to drop, tuition continues to rise. Is that a tough set of conditions in which to ask for more money for the workers?
Well, it would be a whole lot tougher if there wasn't this rampant hiring of administrators and high administrative salaries. And it's gone on throughout the state over the last 10 years. There's been an increase in the student-to-administrator ratio, or a decrease in the student-to-administrator ratio. So there's more administrators per student. And a severe decrease the other way, where there's far less faculty and far less classified workers, frontline workers, to students. So the people who serve the students, rather than the administration, we're decreasing in numbers, and administration not only increasing, but with sometimes pretty obscene salaries to go with it. Lots of six-figure salaries, especially at the big three. There's lots of six-figure salaries, and if there's going to be money available, it could be tightened up in that area. We also had a proposal that on the table that management refused to talk to us about. It's called a permissive subject of bargaining, which means they don't have to. But we started out with a couple proposals, one to limit. To put some definition to staffing ratios, and another two, we wanted the university system to join us in petitioning the governor to go after the big banks that stole the money out of the Oregon Treasury in 2008 and just before the big crash. We felt it was something good, not just for the university system, but the whole state of Oregon to try and recover that money. There's been other states that have successfully sued the big banks and gotten millions and millions of dollars back, and they absolutely refused to even talk to us about it. They were not interested in pursuing that.
When you say stole the money, what do you mean there?
Well, you know, in the big crash, where all the fraud and the big banking scandal, where the money was illegally moved around, and the mortgages, the fake mortgages and everything. This money, Oregon University System and the state of Oregon, had money invested in these funds that were robbed of the money because of these schemes that were going on. And, I mean, every state did. Every state treasury, they don't just keep the money in the, credit union. They invest it all over the world and part of the investments, a significant amount of investment, was in these funds that funded the things where the big banks were stealing the money from.
So SEIU suggested going after that, and OUS said, nope, not going to happen?
Yeah. I mean, we said before there's further cuts to us, we didn't even say get a result. We said before there's further cuts to us, join us in petitioning the governor to sue the banks, and they wouldn't even talk about it.
You mentioned strikes in 1987. I remember that one in 1995. How long did either of those last against the universities?
1987, I believe they were both 1 week. And they were both against the entire state because the university system didn't begin to split off from DAS until 1995. Senate Bill 271 in 1995 gave them some autonomy in the areas of things like purchasing and land management and, you know, real estate, that certain areas of the administration where they didn't have to be in the state pools for that stuff anymore, and loss control and, motor pool, all that. They weren't contributors to that anymore. And then in 2011, there was Senate Bill 242, which actually made the university systems no longer state agencies. So we are no longer state employees. We are employees of the Oregon University System.
All right. So the strike authorization for the 23rd of September withdrawn, replaced by a strike authorization for the 30th of September. When is the next bargaining session? Because it sounds like things are looking up.
Yeah, it was. We're scheduled to meet in Eugene on this Wednesday.
And Wednesday will be the 18th. Okay, so still a chance that a strike could be averted, you think?
Say that again?
Still a chance a strike can be averted?
Oh, absolutely. There's lots of days between then, and our bargaining team is willing to drop what we're doing and get in at a moment's notice. We'll come in from all over the state, but if they call us and say be there at midnight tonight, we'll drop what we're doing and be there at midnight. It doesn't matter. We want to get this done. We don't want a strike. We're just being forced into it.
All right. Mark Neisenfeld, SEIU Local 503 Bargaining Team Chair. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 16th of September, 2013. It was on this day in 1853, Henry Steinway, who'd come from Hamburg in 1849, sold his first American-made piano with a cast-iron frame, which allowed a piano to be strung with greater tension on the strings and with the bass strings crossing above the treble strings so they could be longer and make a grander sound. It's the birthday of James J. Hill, born in southern Ontario, 1838, who built the Great Northern Railroad from St. Paul all the way to Seattle. It's the birthday of the novelist John Knowles, born in Fairmont, West Virginia, 1926. His father was the vice president of a coal company, sent the boy to Phillips Exeter Academy. Knowles later wrote, "The summer of 1943 at Exeter was as happy a time as I ever had in my life." He went on to Yale. He met the playwright Thornton Wilder, who became his mentor. Knowles wrote a novel called Descent into Proselito, which he sent to Thornton Wilder, who told the young man he doubted he was actually interested in what he was writing about. And so John Knowles sat down to write a novel set during World War II, the action taking place at an elite boys' boarding school like Phillips Exeter. And that novel was a separate piece published in 1959, which went on to become an enormous bestseller. And it's the birthday of Henry Louis Gates, Jr., born in Keyser, West Virginia, 1950. Literary critic and teacher at Harvard, who in the winter of 2001 saw an auction catalog listing a manuscript by a woman named Hannah Crafts, The Story of a Slave's Life. He bought the manuscript and determined that it was written by a young African-American woman who had escaped from slavery, and he turned the manuscript into a novel, The Bondwoman's Narrative. It was published in 2002 and became a national bestseller. Here's a poem for today by Kim Dover. They're taking chocolate milk off the menu. And that's only the beginning. I hear other junk food is at risk. Brownies, pastries, name it, they're removing it. The only chance fifth graders have at happiness. The only thing I looked forward to was chocolate milk, especially after getting yelled at by Miss Paniutu. I once poured a carton over her inbox, watched the ink bleed down the equation-filled pages, blurring the names of my classmates. Never told anyone, not even Donna Nagy. And now they're taking it off the menu. What will our kids be forced to do? Will they devour each other, eat one another's faces, run across the handball court sword fighting with dry straws, wasted with desire? Word just in, they're even removing strawberry milk. We never had that. I'm sure it didn't smell like the chocolate, a little sour, like yesterday's dessert. We had to drink it before it turned, when it was still cold enough that even our mittens couldn't protect us. A poem by Kim Dover, They're Taking Chocolate Milk Off the Menu, from her collection Slice of Moon, published by Red Hen Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by LendingTree, where you can fill out one form and receive up to 5 loan offers at trylendingtree.com, NMLS 1136. Produced by Joy Biles, assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.